to Cascadia Public Radio.
Today on Flashpoints, Nora Barros Friedman reports on the illegal arrests and detention of 10-year-old and 12-year-old Palestinian brothers by Israeli security forces. Also, a special report from Chiapas, Mexico, where state security forces are cracking down on indigenous communities who they are falsely accusing of involvement in the drug trade. We'll hear from Dr. Maz Gilbert, who treated the victims of Israel's use of unconventional weaponry last year in the Gaza attack, and students and teachers protest budget cuts all over this state. We'll continue our day-long coverage. I am Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have a show full of extraordinary information, and we continue our day-long coverage of a protest up and down the state. You heard our speak out on Flashpoints last night from all the way out of San Diego and all the way up north. Today, everywhere there are protests. There are ongoing protests in the major cities around California, including Oakland. And joining us, if all goes well with our technology, we're going to be joined by Colleen Madoff. Are you there, Colleen?
Yes, I am.
Where exactly are you now?
I'm actually just in Oak downtown Oakland right now. I stepped into a restaurant to have some tea so I could have a moment to talk to you.
Well, thank you for taking a second out. Tell us what your day was like today.
Well, my day started very early since I talked to the press. So I came to the UC Berkeley campus at 5 o'clock in the morning. But most people got to campus by around 7 o'clock when the picket lines started. So there were picket lines at a number of locations in campus. The strongest and most visible picket line was at Fathergate, where people were prevented from walking across campus, both through the gate and through the two exits kind of around the gate. The pickets continued until noon, at which time we had a rally that started in the streets at Bancroft and Telegraph. We had approximately between 1,000 and 1,500 people at that rally, and who had a march from there all the way to downtown Oakland, a five-mile march, took a couple of hours. When we joined the rally that was already going on in Frank Ogawa Plaza.
All right, and that's ongoing now? Is that continuing?
No, the rally has finished. I believe that there are a small number of people who are who continue to march with it, although I'm actually unclear. I don't have any updates on them.
All right, let me just interrupt right here. Let's just get right to the core for you. And tell us about what's happening here. How does this affect you? And how have you seen this affect your friends, their families? What's going on?
Well, of course, the most visible thing that's happened within the UC has been the 32% fee increase that will finish being in effect next fall. A lot of people have already said that they'll be unable to return to school in the fall because of this fee increase. The total in-state tuition will be over $10,000 a year, which is just an extraordinary amount. It's double what it was even just. And so we're seeing that, but at the same time that we're seeing this fee increase, we're seeing a lot of things that are cut on campus. And but the only thing that's not being cut is administrative spending and building and construction. So we've seen $1.35 billion in new building and construction loans that have been taken out, according to some, using our tuition as collateral. It's extraordinary to watch the changes that are happening at the university.
All right, let's bring in Asas. Are you there? Are you with us? I think you're in Oakland as well. You've been out all day. Hi, Asas. Are you with us? Asas, yes? I think maybe we lost him. All right. Well, Collie, final word from you as we continue our all-day coverage. Is this an end point for you, or are today's protests just the beginning of organization by students such as yourself from UC Berkeley, from the community colleges, from the high school? Well, where does this go now?
Certainly, this is just the beginning. This is our first public attempt to organize across educational systems within California, and then, of course, across the nation, where there have been, I believe, over 120 actions in 33 states.
All right. Well, we're going to keep tuned right on in. We're going to keep covering this as we report here from the mothership, KPFA, in Berkeley, California. Actions taking from one end of this state to the other. We're hearing from some students today. A beautiful speak out last night. We'll continue our coverage. Please be careful and keep us posted, Collie.
Thank you. Will do.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As I said, this station and this network will be covering these kinds of issues really from the ground up on a daily basis. But now we're going to have to change the subject. We've got a major breaking story. We made contact with our hopefully making contact with our correspondent on the ground in Chiapas. Alejandro Reyes reported today from Chiapas that there are fairly brutal attacks by the security forces who are using the guise of indigenous communities being involved in the drug trade to crack down and to undermine many changes that have been happening that you've heard about since the Zapatista revolution. Alejandro Reyes, you're in Chiapas now, correct? Alejandro Reyes, can you hear us now? We're going to do our best to get Alejandro Reyes on the line with this breaking story. I want to tell you also coming up on this broadcast, we'll speak to Dr. Mads Gilbert, who was on the front line in Gaza treating the victims from the unconventional warfare that was heaped down upon them. That's coming up, too. I think we have Alejandro Reyes on the line now. Alejandro, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Dennis. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, you're in Chiapas or just have come from Chiapas. Tell us what's going on the ground there.
Sure. I am in Chiapas in San Cristobal de las Casas. And there is a pretty alarming situation here with a number of trouble spots around the state in Zapatista communities or Zapatista people that support Zapatistas, people that belong to the other campaign, that are being attacked by paramilitary groups. There is a heavy increase in paramilitary activity, not really directly the security forces or the army, but the use of these groups that are pro-government groups that are heavily armed. I was yesterday at a community called Michiton, which is not far away from San Cristobal de las Casas, where I am, and interviewing the people. This Sunday, this paramilitary group called the Army of God kidnapped three people, including community authorities, tortured them, threatened to set them on fire. And when people from the community tried to rescue them, they shot at them, wounded one person with a gunshot. The other six people were seriously wounded with clubs and rocks. And the community ended up blocking the road for several hours to force the government into doing something. When the federal police troops came, they did absolutely nothing to save the hostages, which were only let go after 12 hours of captivity and torture. The Army of God is an evangelical paramilitary group. They call themselves soldiers of God. They wear military uniforms. They have military. When I was there, I saw several of them coming down the road with loads of blankets and other goods received from the government after a meeting. And last July, they had killed one community member. They ran over him with a truck. They seriously wounded five other people. Now, the important thing is that this community is right on the pathway of the highway that government is trying to build that will unite, that will lead from San Cristobal de las Casas, which is a city, colonial city, to the ruins of Palenque. And along this line, they plan to create a very large tourism development. These are projects that have a partnership between the state government and the federal government and international capital. And so along those same lines, in another community, this one is a Zapatista community called Bolonajao. It is right next to the waterfalls of Agua Azul, which is a very famous tourist destination in Chiapas. The people who control the waterfalls are pro-government peasants affiliated to this organization. It's a paramilitary organization called Organization for the Defense of Indigenous and Peasant Rights. It's a very violent organization. In January, they invaded a very large lot of land that belonged to Zapatistas. The Zapatistas recuperated from large landowners in the 1994 uprising. They want to build a tourist lodge here, the government and international capital, linked to a hotel in Palenque and a golf course elsewhere, right on Zapatista land, next to these waterfalls, because there are other waterfalls that are absolutely beautiful that are on Zapatista land. Zapatista organized to retake the land. The people from Afik left. They came back. The guns attacked them, invaded the community, shot at them. Several people were wounded in the fire from the Optic people themselves. They killed one of their own people. And the media portrayed this as a Zapatista attack, and the army threatened to invade the community, obviously with the intention of taking that land away from the Zapatistas. There are things happening in the Montes Azules Reserve. It's a mountainous region that is extremely rich in natural resources. Two communities were removed by the government. Eight more communities are set for removal. The plan here, again, is to build another major so-called ecotourism resort, again, with state-federal partnership with international capital. And yesterday, Zapatista authorities of another region, Agarrucha, set out an urgent warning. The same organization that attacked Bolonajao has threatened to attack the Zapatista community of Santo Domingo, their land. They gave them to today as the deadline to leave their land before they attack. Obviously, Zapatistas are not about to leave, and we're waiting to hear whether or not there was an attack and what is happening. The important thing about all of this, Dennis, is that these are not isolated events. These are clearly a strategy, a government strategy, this articulates resistance to all of these major tourism developments, to this articulates Zapatista resistance. And I was talking to the people from the Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center yesterday, and their evaluation is that the conditions here are very similar to what was seen in 95-96, which led to the massacre of Ateo in 97, which you might remember. 40-some people were killed while they were praying in a church.
And this was by paramilitary forces closely linked with the government and the polluted government forces that are in bed with these international entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. These were exactly the same thing, paramilitary forces. That time, in 97, all the warning signs were there, just like today. Nobody did absolutely anything. The difference is that we're in a worse condition, because back there, at least the public was hearing about it. There were a lot of reporters, you know, the Zapatista uprising a few years before. Right now, there is absolutely no media coverage. There's total media blackout or a manipulation by Mexico to portray this as Zapatista aggressions or simply as conflicts between indigenous people that have nothing to do with major political scene and certainly not with the government. There's no attention whatsoever. In Mexico, very little. Only the La Jornada newspapers covering it, so-so. Oftentimes also the La Jornada not covering it well and portraying the government story. And outside of Mexico, we're not hearing anything. And the people from these communities that I've talked to, the people from the human rights centers, are asking people around the world to be pay close attention to what is going on, to these warning signs, because they're very afraid that something tragic can happen at any time.
All right, and we're out of time, but just so in case people miss the point, one of the ways that these paramilitary forces are working with the government is to accuse these indigenous communities of essentially fighting with each other over their chunk in the drug trade and other very ridiculous stories that have so much more to do with government and military involvement in the drug trade and this kind of international illegal entrepreneuring. We're going to have to leave it right there, but we're going to come back really soon to you, Alejandro Reyes, reporting from San Cristobal, Chiapas, where security forces, Mexican security forces, cracking down and paramilitary forces sort of picking up the ball there. Please be careful and keep us posted, Alejandro.
We'll do it, Dennis. We'll keep in touch.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break. We're going to come back with Dr. Mads Gilbert. We also have a report from Nora Barris Friedman. Barbara Lubin is in the house. There's a great deal going on. Please stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. You know, a little more than a year ago, this show devoted every minute of its time to reporting on the slaughter in the Gaza Strip by land, air, sea, however you could attack, and with a variety of weaponry that included non-conventional weaponry we came to know as things like the dime bomb. This was a tragedy. Over 1,400 people died, over 300 children died. So many churches, schools, homes, apartment buildings, hospitals. I mean, whole parts of cities were disappeared and razed to rubble. This is a terrible moment in history. One of the people who went there, who was on the front line, medical doctor Mads Gilbert, who has really done exquisite work for some time. He comes out of the University of North Norway and was there, as I said, to take a look at these new kinds of wounds. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you much.
If I could ask you to just lean into that mic and let's just get right to it. What is a dime bomb, and what does it do to the flesh?
A dime bomb is a new type of very highly explosive weapons that is actually developed by the United States Air Force. And what it does to the body is that it actually is wiping away your body parts. These weapons are made to be what is called targeted weapons, meaning they are supposed to kill within a short range of the explosion. It's made from dense, inert heavy metals, an alloy of tungsten, wolfram, and nickel. And when these weapons explode, they create a tremendous ball of heat and power. It's basically evaporated heavy metal. But there are no shrapnels because the charge is within a composite box rather than a metal box. So actually these weapons are developed to do assassinations in a densely crowded area, like in a city. If you want to kill somebody in a car, you can have a drone circling in the air, and you can target a car and kill everyone in the car, but not many people around. Like if you had shot a grenade or a shell, the fragments, the shrapnels would travel for hundreds of meters and kill other people. But it goes without saying that when you apply these weapons in such densely populated areas like Gaza is, where half of the population are children, of course you will have severe tolls and casualties among the civilians. And that's what we saw in Shifa Hospital, where we worked together with the Palestinian doctors. Terrible injuries, awful injuries, like this boy here.
We're looking at a picture where it looks like the body is simply dissolving. It's like being eaten from the inside out.
It's actually in a split second that happened, and both his legs are torn off at the level of the knees. His buttocks were sliced off. He's 14 years old, and he dies between our hands. And we saw many of these injuries. And actually, this technology is developed here in San Francisco.
Oh, really?
I think the people who make them, they know it. And,
Lawrence Livermore Labs.
That's right. That's right. And
a stone's throw.
What is more, maybe even a more important thing to discuss also, is that the residuals of these explosives, if you embed them in muscles of laboratory rats, 100% of these rats will develop muscle cancer within 3 to 4 months and die. So actually these particles are radioactive, low grade emissions of radioactivity, which will cause cancer in experimental animals. We don't know if those surviving these injuries, because we did a large number of amputations in Gaza and Shifa Hospital of people who actually also survived, adults mostly, if they will develop cancer in the years to come, we don't know. But the bottom line, I think, from my and Dr. Eric's experience in Shifa was that the Israeli onslaught on Gaza was violating all types of international laws, and I think it was an attack on the common humanitarian platform that the Western civilization likes to say that we are standing on, and that is respect for humankind, respect for individuals, respect for civilians, and that nobody should be killed without a trial.
Now, these weapons, just to be clear, developed in the U.S., developed in the Bay Area around the U.S., and rushed over, you could say, that's fair to say, rushed over to Israel in time for the Gaza slaughter.
Well, they were actually first applied by the Israeli Air Force during the invasion and the attack on Lebanon in 2006. And in 2006, I happened to be in Gaza in July, and that's when the Israelis were conducting the Operation Summer Rain on Gaza, where I saw these injuries for the first time. So they are, you're right, they're quite new, and they are supplied by the United States Air Force to the State of Israel, and they are used to kill civilians.
Well, I guess there was a serious replenishing of Israeli
Absolutely.
Weaponry and stockpiles just in time ironically, for the slaughter.
Well, without a very strong financial and military support from the U.S., of course, Israel could not conduct these attacks, and they could not continue for more than 3 weeks without being stopped.
We're speaking with Dr. Mads Gilbert. He is a frontline doctor who went to the Gaza Strip to try and help and mitigate some of the suffering from this brutal, savage 3 week attack that really on a population that could not flee and was simply stuck to respond. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Also in the studio with me is Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance, who has been to Gaza a couple of times since the slaughter and went there very soon after to see it.
Well, I was actually there the last day of the onslaught, what happened in Gaza, and also was there for 2 weeks after that and interviewed many people at Shifa Hospital and this, at Al-Alda Hospital and some of the other hospitals. In fact, we brought an ambulance with an operating room in and 5 tons of medicine and lots of other things that were needed. But I remember being in Shifa Hospital and this father, his name was Zaki, and he heard me speaking in English and he came running out and he grabbed me and he said, "Come here, I want you to see my son." And it's very unusual for Muslim families to disrobe themselves or their children in front of anybody. But he said, "I want you to take a picture of this. I want you to see this." And he pulled the sheets back. And his 16-year-old son was lying there, and this boy had gone out to look for some bread for his family and was hit by a dime bomb. And it looked like a shark had taken a huge bite out of his thigh and the back of his leg. And I'm just wondering, Doctor, what's happening now to these young people or old people who were hit? I mean, is there any way to recover from this? What is happening?
Reporting from occupied Palestine, where our senior producer, Nora Bowes-Friedman, is standing. Well, we're hearing this. Whatever's going on there, we're listening to that. So we need to hold that for a moment. We're going to go late to Nora, so just hold on there. Sorry. Little technical problem here. This is Barbara Lubin, and you were just asking.
I'm just curious. What happened to all those kids that I saw?
Well, this is a very important question. And the Palestinians, unfortunately, are extremely talented and experienced in dealing with war injuries. I was in Beirut in 1982 working in hospitals there, and I've seen over the 15 years that I've been working in Gaza that they are extremely good at taking care of also the victims, the survivors, but they need supplies, they need financial support, they need the technical support. They don't necessarily need a large bunch of Western doctors coming in. What they need is to support to maintain their own capacity to do rehabilitation. One important institution in Gaza is the Gaza Municipality Artificial Limb Shop, which are making great prostheses, but they need funding to make these prostheses. They were at the brink of being shut down because of the blockade of Gaza in 2006, and we have collected around $1 million in Norway to keep this prosthesis workshop open.
Great.
And they have made more than 1,000 artificial limbs and other types of supportive material for these survivors since this money collection started. So I think the American public and the Bay Area people should look for concrete projects where they can support them, not necessarily going there, but empowering the Palestinian people to take care of their war survivors. And we have to remember that half the population in Gaza, 50% of the population, is below 15 years, and 60% is below 18 years. This is a child prison with 750,000 children being bombed, being terrified. The Israelis bombed 280 schools. None of these schools have been rebuilt. So the rehabilitation of the society is the number one priority now. And in order for all these survivors of their wounds, like you talked about in the hospital, the most important thing is not drugs. It is to get back to normal life. It is to have clean water and food and security and go to school and to kindergarten and to see their parents having, you know, work.
Yeah.
So I think our common duty now is to force the Norwegian government, the American government, to put pressure on Israel to lift the siege of Gaza. I mean, we may disagree about a lot of things, but to keep 1.5 million people sieged for years after years and starved out, it is an attack on our humanity, on our morality, on our common platform of values.
And just in a few seconds, I mean, your frontline experience, your experience in human rights work, what you saw and the way in which you understand this suffering was imposed, is this what you would support as a war crime, as a crime against humanity?
Well, I'm not a law expert, so I would leave that to the International Criminal Court. But I for sure want to see the Goldstone Report go to Hague, and I think it's mandatory that the United States of America do not pose a veto when the Security Council is handling the Goldstone Report. I think it's been very shameful the way this commission has been treated by the Israelis and the American power people. And I think the report itself, for everyone who has read it, I've read it myself,
yeah,
it is a piece of, I would say, almost scientific autopsy of the attack on Gaza. And of course, those responsible for all these killings, and these children didn't die. They were killed. These 1,500, 1,400 Palestinians, they didn't die. They were killed in cold blood. This was cold-blooded murder. And, of course, the perpetrators should be taken to court and given a decent handling, and they should be punished. So my answer is, yes, I think it amounts to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
That's the voice of Dr. Mads Gilbert. Along with Barbara Lubin, they're going to be participating in a very important conference that deals with this issue. For those of you in the Bay Area, Marin County, it's going to be at the First Presbyterian Church of San Anselmo, the Sabeel Conference, Bay Area Sabeel Conference. You can check that out over the weekend, the 5th and the 6th. Dr. Mads Gilbert, the book, his book, which you want to read, I believe translates into English, Eyes in Gaza.
Yes, and the edition in English is due in May, and I hope you will all read it.
I noticed I was having a little trouble reading that. I had trouble reading English,
too. I was looking at it
but,
thinking, what?
Norwegian, or I'm not sure. But anyway, thank you for your incredibly important work. Let's just say, folks, we're running behind time, but what we're going to do now is we're going to meet with Nora Barros Friedman. If we can cue up her piece, we're going to the West Bank with Nora. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening. In Berkeley, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our reporting from occupied Palestine. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our reporting from occupied Palestine, where our senior producer, Nora Barros Friedman, is standing by. She'll be there for the next month reporting for you and for the Flashpoints audience from Ground Zero in this occupied country. Nora, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. I know that one of the major parts of your visit and the reason for your visit is to investigate what's happening with children and how children are being not only affected, but arrested and brutalized. I know you're on a story today. Tell us about what happened with a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Well, yeah. Hi, Dennis. It's good to be back. And, you know, a couple days ago on the show, I was telling you and the audience about my former student, who's 16 years old, 17 years old, and was arrested in the middle of the night and taken to prison for a year. Today, I've been continuing that thread of that storyline, and actually a story that came out this week in Palestine was that on Sunday, I believe it was, the Israeli military arrested two young boys from Halil, from Hebron in the southern occupied West Bank. They were playing near the Ibrahimi Mosque, and the army was there. There were, you know, a large group of right-wing, ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlers there, kind of intimidating the local Palestinians in the area. And the two boys were throwing stones, as is very common in this part of the world. And as I mentioned a few days ago, throwing stones is considered, it's kind of akin to a federal offense, according to the Israeli military, and it carries a heavy fine and imprisonment. You can get up to 10 years in prison if you're a child. The Israeli military took these two boys, one was 10 and his brother was 12, the 12-year-old remains in jail. As of now, he has a court date on Sunday, and he's at Ofra prison where my student, a couple days ago when I was talking about him, he was held for about 9 months. The 10-year-old was taken to inside one of the settlement colonies inside Hebron called Kiryat Arba, where he was blindfolded and handcuffed and forced to sit on the chair for about 8 to 10 hours. He couldn't really tell how much time had passed because, of course, there's no clocks, and the Israeli soldiers wouldn't let him.
This is the 10-year-old child,
this little child, 10 years old. He still, you know, has wobbly teeth. You know, he's still getting teeth. He's a child. I mean, a kid.
And just to be clear, you interviewed him. You went to the family and you interviewed him.
And I interviewed him and his mother and father. He was held there for about 8 to 10 hours. They, as I said, they handcuffed him, they blindfolded him, they terrorized him. I asked him if they had beaten him. He said no, but they were shouting it. They're shouting a lot. They were, you know, insulting him and his family. They were just terrifying him. They put a dog, a large German shepherd, right next to him as he was blindfolded and handcuffed, and they would provoke the dog into barking, which, you know, terrified the child even more. Wet himself. He was extremely frightened. The Israeli military wouldn't tell him, really where he was or how long he was going to be there. Finally, the mother and father found out through some neighbors who saw it happen that he and his brother were at this Kiryat Arba settlement detention center. And the father actually managed at about 11 o'clock at night to come and retrieve his child and take him back home. And the 12-year-old, as I said, is still in prison. He has a court date on Sunday. There was kind of a hearing a couple days ago, maybe yesterday, and the Israeli lawyer, human rights lawyer, who works on cases specifically for Palestinian children who are arrested by the Israeli military, she said that, she was at the hearing, and just to prove a point that as a child, the 12-year-old was very nervous and of course terrified, and she dug through her bag and she pulled out a red balloon and she gave the balloon to the, she blew up the balloon and gave the balloon to the kid, and the kid was playing with it. It was such an act of, of kind of like proving that this kid was a kid, that the Israeli military had arrested and terrified a child. Apparently the judge in the hearing was so ashamed. There are cameras around. He was ashamed to be there. That's what the parents said. But still, the child was sent to prison, and he remains there today. And when I was talking to the parents and the little boy, the 10-year-old, his younger brother, about what had happened, it was just, unbearable. This kid, he was a carefree kid last week, playing all the time. He was up on the roof playing. He would, be out in the streets playing with his friends. And apparently now he doesn't even want to go to school. He doesn't want to go visit anybody. He doesn't want to leave the house. He's extremely terrified of the settlers and the soldiers who are just outside. You know, this family lives in the old city, which has been brutalized and terrorized by these extremist, violent settler groups who are just becoming more and more empowered by this Netanyahu administration.
Just explain, you see, you refer to the old city, just set the scene.
The old city of Hebron is, you know, it's one of the places in the West Bank, one of the only places actually in the West Bank where settlers have set up their colonies inside a Palestinian city. Most of the settlement colonies in the West Bank are, kind of outside on top of hills, in open spaces on the edge of villages, which they eat up. To expand their colonies. But this one, the Hebron settlement colonies are inside the actual Palestinian villages. And of course, this is the same scenario that's repeated in occupied East Jerusalem, where the settlement colonies are forever expanding inside Palestinian neighborhoods and villages. The old city is where, in 1994, a right-wing settler opened fire inside the Ibrahimi Mosque, killing 29 Palestinians. The old city is where the city has been effectively split into two parts, where Palestinians are forced into one enclave while the settler groups have full reign of most of the old city, where they're protected by the Israeli military soldiers. And they, every time settlers want to hold a rally, the military shuts off part of the city to protect them. Every time the settlers want to move into someone's house and take it over, the Israeli military protects them. This is an extremely violent and unbelievable part of the West Bank. It's a microcosm of the entire situation, of course, but especially in Hebron, it's extremely dangerous for Palestinians to just wake up in the morning.
All right, let me jump in here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Nora Barros Friedman. She's a senior producer on this show called Flashpoints. It's your daily investigative news magazine. Nora is in the region in occupied Palestine for a month. She had a piece come out just yesterday on the electronic intifada.net. I can't live without this place. Beautiful piece, Nora, and I'm going to talk to you about that in one moment. But now coming back to this family, the 12-year-old is still in jail with the balloon, the red balloon there. The 10-year-old is traumatized. So now say something about how this impacts on the family and where they go from here. How do they figure out if they'll ever see their 12-year-old again or if he's going to be, like, tortured for 12 months?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Everything is very arbitrary. Everything is indefinite. Everything is kind of up in the air in terms of where they go from here. Most likely, because of the attention, the media attention focused on this particular story, the 12-year-old will be released on Sunday. But it doesn't stop once the cameras are turned off, once the news media, turns to the next, headline. The trauma doesn't stop. I was talking to this family, the mother in particular, about how this impacts her and her children and what her biggest concerns are for their future. And she said, it's something that she didn't think whatever she would have to deal with. But of course, as a normal human being, as a normal parent, it's something that, of course, is the most disempowering. It's the most vicious form of daily experience here, and it's something that no mother, no father, no child should ever have to endure. But yet, this happens on a daily basis. It's very regular. And she said, it might happen again. I mean, she basically echoed the mother that I spoke to a few days ago, the mother of the 16, 17-year-old kid who was in jail for a year. She said, look, this is part of the life here. There's nothing that we can do. There's no recourse. There's no legal way to protect our children. It's up to the international community. It's up to people all for the world to figure out what's going on and stop it. It's up to the United Nations and the International Criminal Court to take the Israeli officials who make these just draconian and disgusting military laws possible. It's up to them to take these people to court and prosecute them. This is a clear violation of not only the Geneva Conventions, but the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child. And even this is a violation of even the Israeli military law itself, which says that that children under 12 can't be arrested. They can't be held for any amount of time. So the Israeli military even broke their own rules in arresting and torturing and detaining this child, this 10-year-old child. And this is, you know, this is not a new story. This is not an anomaly. This is not something that's just going to happen once and never happen again. This is going to happen again and again until someone stops it. And that is the most atrocious part of this whole thing, is that this trauma, this collective trauma, this personal trauma, will happen again and again and again to the same family, to the same community, same population of people here under occupied military apartheid rule here in Palestine.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, speaking with Nora Barris Friedman on the ground in the occupied West Bank, illegally occupied. We never hear about that word in this context. It's extraordinary. One of the key censored stories of our time, but this is a story that we've chosen to cover, and Nora has thrown her whole life into it. Nora, we just have a minute left, but I want to talk to you about the story that appears on electronicintifada.net. Tell us about what you tried to do there. Tell us about how it got the name I Can't Live Without This Place.
Well, this is a story, my first story for Electronic Intifada, this time around. This is a story about the current and ongoing ethnic cleansing that's happening here, the expansion of these settlement colonies on Palestinian land, the expansion of home demolitions, the expansion of Israeli military laws that are racist and apartheid in nature. This is a story about a man whose father and grandfather and many generations before them were born in this little tiny village called Al-Walija. Al-Walija, I think I explained a couple days ago, was ethnically cleansed beginning in 1948 when Israel stole two-thirds of the village land and turned it into two settlements, Gilo and Har Gilo. And now the settler community, if you want to call it that, backed by a private company which develops settlement colonies, are trying to build a settlement on this last third of the remaining land of Al-Walija. They want to call it Givat Ya'el, and they want to put 45,000 Jewish Israelis into that settlement, and they eventually want to connect these three settlements, Gilo, Har Gilo, and Givat Ya'el, to the Gush Etzion settlement block, which is one of the largest in the Bethlehem Hebron area. And this man decided 15 years ago, most of the population of Al-Walija is either passed away, or the descendants are now in Dehesha refugee camp, which is right here in Bethlehem. He decided 15 years ago that he wasn't going to be a refugee anymore, and he found his way back to Al-Walija, which is actually just about a 10-minute drive from Bethlehem, through the woods. It's on a beautiful hillside that overlooks Jerusalem. And because Israeli military law forbids any home building by Palestinians on their village lands, if any home is built or even expanded or, fixed, renovated, they come and destroy it. It's part of, they just prohibit any growth in this zone, because they want to expand these settlements into it and take more and more land, which is, the policy here. So he came about 15 years ago and set himself up inside a cave, a 4,000-year-old cave, And he's been planting all sorts of fruits and vegetables. He has a chicken coop and rabbits. And he talked about his story. He talked about his right to this land. He actually went to Israeli court to prove that this land was his from generations and generations ago. The Israeli court, couldn't deny that. He had, papers from the Ottoman Empire, from the British Mandate period, from the Jordanian administration, and then finally, from the Israeli administration as well, proving that this was his land, with all these documents and ID cards and everything. And he's been living there, and he's living alone. His family lives in Dehesha camp still. His family, his friends, his colleagues are all here in Bethlehem. But he's alone on this hillside, this beautiful hillside, and he actually loves it. He said in the story, I couldn't live without this place. I come here every I'm here every day. I plant something new every day. When sometimes he goes back to see his family in Dehesha, and he stays for a night or two, and he said that every time he sleeps over there, all he dreams about is his land, and he can't wait to get back to it. Settlers have come and tried to bribe him with millions of dollars in bribe money to get him to leave, and he's refused time and time again. He's faced attacks, he's faced detention, he's faced arrests. He gets brought to the nearby checkpoint every once in a while and put in detention and then released, and then he goes back to his land. I mean, it's this ongoing tumultuous story, but the resilience and the tenacity that he has to stay where his family was born, where his roots are from, is unwavering. And so that's the story that I wrote for Electronic Intifada.
And that's the story today from Noora Barros Friedman in Bethlehem, reporting for Flashpoint. She is the senior producer for this show, seventh year in a row, where she's been on the ground for us, reporting, working with young people. All of this is crucial. We look forward to more of the reporting you're going to do on young people and the general situation there. Noora, you're doing a great job. Please be careful, and we'll talk to you really soon.
Great. Thanks, Dennis.